Welcome to the Pitch Deck, your backstage pass inside the startup funding game. You'll discover real insights from experienced investors who make big bets on young companies and amazing founders who raise the cash they needed to take their company to the next level. Let's join your host, angel investor and serial entrepreneur, Gavin McCauley.
Welcome to the Pitch Deck, where we bring you inside the startup funding game. If you're an entrepreneur who is raising capital or even thinking about raising capital, this show was created for you. Every single day, we are bringing the most active and influential angel investors, venture capitalists, and founders who have raised serious funding for their company so that you can learn what it takes to raise money for your business. I'm your host, Gavin McCauley, and today I have an amazing guest that I am so excited to introduce to you because he brings an amazing perspective that I'm not even sure we've ever had on the show, Mr. Jeffrey Finkel. Jeffrey is an ex-entrepreneur and an ex-executive in a software industry and an ex-venture capitalist, but currently a startup coach and angel investor. So what an amazing perspective. Welcome to the Pitch Deck, Jeffrey.
Wow. Thank you.
I just love it.
That was quite an intro.
Well, actually, I didn't give too much. So I gave just a little tiny glimpse of all of these X's that are in front of your names, right, to our audience. Will you take us a step back and tell us about yourself and tell us about some of these things that you did as an entrepreneur, as an executive in the software industry, as a venture capitalist, and what led you to, you know, being an angel investor where you are now, just so that our listeners can sort of understand you and understand the perspective that you bring to this game. We're just looking forward to getting to know you.
Okay, great. So I initially started as an entrepreneur. Back in the mid-80s, I started a company in Boston called Enhance Systems. And we were developing at the time storage subsystems, basically the precursor to CD-ROMs, which everybody uses now to store permanent data. And, you know, I knew nothing about fundraising. I really knew nothing about starting a business, but somehow we managed to stay in business for 7 years. We grew revenue to a little over $4 million. And then for a variety of reasons in the early 90s, we had to shut the business down. At that point, I joined another startup company that was run by a friend of mine. And collectively, we sold that company to Cheyenne Software in 1993. So at the time, Cheyenne was a fast-growing IT infrastructure software company. And my colleague Wayne and myself went on and sort of grew up at Cheyenne, and over a 4-year period, you know, rose up to fairly senior executive roles. In 1997, Cheyenne was sold to Computer Associates, and Wayne and I went forward with CA. And, you know, so through Cheyenne and CA, as an operating executive, I was on the business side. So I was running a division. I ran the product management function. And I also spent half of my time on the corporate business development function, acquiring software and service companies. So I was always sort of on either side, the operating side or the deal side. So in 1999, I had the opportunity to get into venture capital. I was recruited to be a founding general partner in a startup fund. It was called Odeon Capital Partners. We ended up raising $100 million. And for me, it was the right choice because I could really leverage both sides of my experience and skill set, that being finding the deals, structuring the deals, and negotiating them, but then also playing a mentorship role with the companies and leveraging my operational experience. So that was great. And, you know, your listeners may or may not know, venture capital funds have a 10-year life. So at the end of 10 years, you have to wind down the fund. You have to distribute the holdings that you have back to your limited partners and either raise a new fund or go on to do something else. So in 2009, I wound down Odeon, got rid of all my companies except for one. And that company, I became executive chairman. And over a 5-year period, we helped that company straighten itself out, grow. And I'm happy to say we sold that company this summer to a financial buyer. But in addition to that, I was lucky enough to become the co-founder or one of the founding partners of the Archangel Fund, where I co-chair the evaluation committee. And ARC is a member-managed angel fund here in New York City, and we invest in the Metro New York area for companies that are really at the seed stage. So what that means is they've raised their friends and family around, they've built a little bit of code, but they're certainly far from product market fit. They're really at the point where there's evidence that suggests it's going to be a business, but certainly no surety that it is going to be a business. And so that's typically where angel and seed investors engage, and that's where ARK engages, and it's been a rewarding experience. We have 21 companies. So that's where I do my angel investing. And then in addition to that, we also have a practice, you know, as an adjunct to a venture law firm, where we provide startup consulting to early stage companies. We essentially help them demystify the fundraising process.
Jeffrey, what a phenomenal, you know, story that you have. And I mean, you told it in a very brief period of time, but it spanned decades and is packed with huge events like, you know, starting a company and having to wind it down and then getting into another venture and then being acquired and acquired twice and into bigger and bigger corporations. And then, you know, starting going over into venture capital and parlaying all that experience. I love it. It was just a phenomenal story. And it's one that resonates with me personally, because when you were ready to be a venture capitalist, you brought so much more than capital, you know, to the table. You had spent time in the acquisition world and doing deals and understanding deal structure. And on the other side, you know, as an operating partner, I mean, just such relevant experience. And then moving forward and into the Archangel Fund and where you are today is just another piece of that pie, that puzzle that founders are out there right now trying and struggling and looking for funding and trying to figure out who the right investor is for them at this stage. And as you said, the seed stage and the just a little bit past concept, a little bit of code. Is this going to be viable? Is it not? It's where you're going to step in. Just phenomenal story. Thank you for sharing it with us. Now that we've gotten to know you a little bit better, you know, now the founders have that understanding of the advice that you're going to give them for the rest of the interview. And as you had said, you know, where you are right now in terms of your mentorship and your participation in this venture law firm about helping demystify the fundraising process, that's the point of this show. And so what a perfect guest you are. So thanks for being here. We're excited. Let's get started. So Jeffrey, tell me a little bit about, you know, your investment philosophy. And you had talked about the stage of company, but are there certain sectors and categories that you are looking to get into? And just so that we can get a little more color around what your particular interest is.
Yeah, so sure. And, you know, that changes as the landscape changes. But right now I have, you know, a heightened focus on the Internet of Things. Mobile, or what I would broadly say, pervasive computing technologies. That means mobile wearables and so forth. And I'm also interested in digital currency and the Bitcoin space. And, you know, as an adjunct to the Bitcoin space, things that can leverage the blockchain, which is the enabling capability, which enables Bitcoin and other digital currency. So those sectors, as well as SaaS, software as a service, business facing, for the most part, vertical and horizontal. And I still have, based on my legacy background, an interest in enterprise software and IT infrastructure.
Phenomenal. So you are a techie at heart, and that is good to know. Obviously, I'm sure you look beyond that, but it's good to know, because there are so many techies out there who are listening to this show right now, so they know where this advice is coming from, and that is phenomenal. So tell me, Jeffrey, if you're looking at a company, and let's just say that it fits the specific sectors you're looking for, certain stage, et cetera, what are a couple of the must-haves that you need that, you know, to consider investing in a company at the stage and in the sector that you're in?
Yeah. So a few things. And I'm not sure I would call them must-haves as much as things that I deem of paramount importance. So the first is, I tend to be attracted to founders that have deep domain experience in the field that they're applying technology to. So if you think about it, there are really three different types of founders, right? There's the technical founder that kind of understands how to solve a technical problem. And sometimes they're more useful in IT infrastructure, But so that's one class. The next is, you know, sort of the business founder. He might be a young MBA who sort of can understand where there's gaps in the markets from a studied or academic viewpoint. And then lastly, there's the deep domain expert. So this could be somebody who's been in a particular field for 10, 20 years, that's been wrestling, deeply, deeply wrestling with problems in that field, that's made executing his or her job far too difficult, and has been trying for a number of years to solve those problems internally. I think that kind of founder has a much more heightened sense of a few things. Number one, what those customers in that space will and won't do, what they'll accept, and really the nuance of how to solve those problems in such a way where people who are not deep domain experts can only do through many, many, many iterations. And to thinking, particularly as a seed investor, they're going to get to product market fit in a much more financially efficient way than somebody who doesn't come from that lineage.
You know, that is an amazing way to think about composing your team, right? I mean, you're talking about having somebody who has lived and breathed and understands the ins and the outs. And so if you're a technical co-founder or a technical founder and you have this this product and, you know, that you're designing and you're the one who came up with maybe the initial idea, finding that other founder who's got that deep domain expertise is so relevant. I mean, I just can't even overstate how many landmines you'll the learning curve that person brings is just invaluable. And so that's such a great insight. We don't often talk about deep domain expertise. We often talk about the team as being a must have, but we don't talk about that expertise.
So team is important. I've actually written a number of blog posts about deep domain experts and teams. Team is important. But I can honestly tell you that if there isn't a real, deeply felt problem to solve that is deeply felt, deeply needed, such that people are willing to overpay for an inferior version of the product today because it solves such a visceral pain point, then the team is not going to execute themselves out of a bad idea. So team is important, but for me, the problem identification and the readiness of the market to accept that is more important. And that could be a controversial statement, but that's the way I look at the world.
But I don't take any controversy with that statement based on the fact that it's truth, right? It's real. It's being honest with yourself and saying, yeah, you might be really smart, really fired up about something, but if the market isn't as fired up as you are, that you really don't have a business, you have a passion or a hobby. And it's just really holding up a mirror to the situation. And I love it because cold, hard truth from an investor early on can save a lot of heartache down the road. I love it. So thank you for sharing that insight.
Yeah. Two quick resources too. So I'll be a shameless promoter for a moment. I've written a little bit about this in my own blog post called thinkabout.it, thinkabout.it. But Mark Andreessen from Andreessen Horowitz just reposted a phenomenal blog post where he compares the relative importance of markets, products, and team. And I think it's just a great resource, and hopefully your listeners will research that post. It's terrific, and it really talks about this very issue.
That is phenomenal. I will link that up in the show notes. I'll link Think About It in the show notes under Jeffrey's episode at thepitchdeck.com. And I will try and get my hands on that that blog post by Mark and link to it as well so that listeners who are interested in finding that can find it under your episode, Jeff, at thepitchdeck.com. So thank you for the phenomenal resource. So moving forward, the name of this podcast is called The Pitch Deck. And the reason it is that so often the first introduction between a startup and an investor like you, Jeffrey, is the pitch. And that could be in front of a large room in a forum, or it could be desk side or table side at Starbucks. But it's the presentation. And so to help our founders understand how to really come out strong with that, can you give us an example of a pitch that just really resonated with you, that really got you fired up? And what did the founders do to captivate you in that presentation to make you want to learn more?
Well, I would say that the single one thing you can tell anybody in a pitch deck that will get their attention is 100% year-over-year growth. But absent that, because not everybody can boast that, I think there are a couple of things that tend to work and generate excitement, the absence of which could create lots of investor confusion. And that is this. I think there's a few things. First, you have to set context. Problem with pitch decks and presenters is that they often know too much, and they know way more than their audience, and they're assuming that context is set when they're presenting a slide on a page. Without context, the investor is scratching his chin. So what I found to be particularly effective is when you do some visual storytelling, it typically starts with either the problem or the unmet need. So connect with the investor and make it experiential. Walk them through what the problem is and why it's felt. The next thing to typically do is to explain the consequence of the problem, and hopefully it's an economic consequence, because if you succeed in connecting with the problem or the unmet need, but there's no consequence, then the investor doesn't care. So problem space, unmet need, in a visceral way where they connect. The next thing you want to accomplish is the consequence of the problem. Then you want to convey ways in which the problem has been solved in the past and why they failed. And then after that, you want to describe the ideal solution or jump right into describing your solution. So I would argue that that first part of the visual storytelling is the most important. Now, after that, you've got to do team, you've got to do milestones, you've got to do market sizing, you've got to do pro forma. There's a lot of things that you have to do, and I have my preferred order in which I like to see them. But I am telling you, if you don't nail that part up front, then you're going to have what I call investor disconnect. And they're going to be always trying to think about, well, what problem are you really solving, and haven't people done that before? So it's critical that you nail that part. And then from there, I think the road is paved. We have some flexibility to convey your information in a variety of ways.
I love the visual that you gave, which was, you know, the presenter who has, you know, a brain full of information, is a domain expert, has lived and breathed this product and problem for so long that either it's very difficult for them to lower their, you know, lower the lexicon and their, you know, the way they communicate to a layman's level with investors so that investors can really understand it. Sometimes I'm shaking my head up and down as you were saying that, because I thought about very technical companies in the technology, especially in the life sciences, where that is often the case. And it's such high level science or it's such high level technology that it becomes very difficult for the founders to bring it down so that investors can grasp truly what it is that they're talking about and understand how it applies. And then I loved the other piece of great advice that you gave, which was demonstrating and showing how the problem was, they attempted to solve the problem in the past, right? It's the old tool and the old way, so that people can understand, hey, this is a real problem that people have been trying to solve for years and years and years, just not effectively. And so they're, you know, if people were willing to spend time, money, and energy solving it, and now you have a better way, like you have your market. And it's just phenomenal advice. I love it because it just sets the content, as you said, set the context for the problem and the process that you're going to do to solve it. And then it just makes the rest of the pitch flow, right? Because now we're talking about details and the plan and the way that you're going to bring that solution to market. And that is just such a different conversation than scratching your head, as you said, the whole time trying to reconcile what is going on here. Phenomenal, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. So let's flip that coin. And let me ask you, what happens in these pitches that completely, when you see it, it's a huge turnoff, and you say, you know what, I wish you hadn't done that, or that's a rookie mistake? Because, and I'm asking this so that founders out there who are getting ready to raise money right now, and are putting their decks together and getting, you know, practicing can sidestep that landmine. They may think it's a good idea to put it in there. It may think it's a good idea to talk about it during a pitch. But Jeffrey, what do you, you know, what say you about that?
Here's how I think about that. Number one, authenticity. So it has to add up. I don't want to hear all about the team up front and have backgrounds blown up to the point where you can see through the remainder of the presentation that it's just not true. So you have to be authentic. I mean, if you are, you know, if you're billing yourself as an expert in developing on Ruby on Rails, but you don't understand Ruby terms, anything that sort of throughout the presentation casts doubt on the presenter. I'd rather have the presenter not know something and indicate he doesn't and be authentic about it, but then to try to sort of represent that he's something that he's not. I think for me, that's the biggest thing. I'd say the second thing is that CEOs and presenters, and the presenter should be the CEO. I don't like to see a room where a CEO and a CFO or a president are sharing the microphone back and forth. The CEO presents. The rest of the team can certainly give color commentary when there's an area that's in their particular field of expertise. But the CEO is driving that presentation. So that CEO, in making that presentation, has to know his numbers. He can't fluff off questions about his prior financing, questions about his cap table, questions about things in the P&L to say, oh, I'll have to get my CFO to get back to you. That's a big no-no. You have to know enough about the numbers to give confidence to the investors who you're presenting that you're going to be a proper fiduciary and steward of the business. So those for me are some of the things that I really get scared about. There's a number of sort of very small things that I would say that you shouldn't do in a presentation. So, right, one is don't say you're willing to give up the CEO spot when somebody better comes along. That very well could happen, and it's probably important at some point in your growth trajectory if the board feels you're not the guy that you're going to do that willingly and what's in the best interest of the company. But when you're pitching for angel and seed money, don't convey that you're ready to give up the CEO spot. That's a big no-no. Don't have a large chunk of equity being given to advisors. That's disproportionate. That just shows weakness. Don't have an advisor try to negotiate your deal with you. You know, you got to be front and center with the investor. Let's see. You know, here's another thing. When people generate their Excel pro forma financial models, it's very hard to have credibility in the out year. So what typically happens is that in the out years, you're going to see like EBITDA margins that are like, you know, 65 or 70% because you haven't figured out how to put enough people in the staffing plan so that you have enough salary expenses in those out years. That just looks terrible. It's very easy for you to go to public companies and look at their financials in industries you're in and make sure that in your out years, you're not projecting something that is deemed out of market and not even achievable by the best companies in your industry publicly. So those are just some quick things. I've got a bunch of other things if you think the audience wants to hear it. But
Jeff, we are all ears because you are an amazing expert. You're an amazing, you know, authority on this. So we are here. I've got you now. I'm not letting you go. Tell me what you got.
Okay, I'm going to give you a few more don'ts. Don't try to create a sense of urgency. In the angel and seed game, you are not going to get funds to fund quicker than their process will allow. Okay, there's a handful of very select companies that are from, you know, second, third, and fourth time entrepreneurs that have huge exits in the past that they can sort of put on a fast track. But, you know, if you're out developing relationships and you're pitching for money, don't tell people they have Friday to get back to you. They're just going to walk. Don't ask for an NDA. I mean, you can ask for an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement from individuals that might be in your space, but for organized funds and or angel networks, don't ask for an NDA. They're not going to sign it. When you're talking about valuation and someone says, well, how'd you come up with that, for example, $4 million pre-money valuation? don't tell them that you've used DCF, which stands for discounted cash flow. That is a typical valuation tool that investment bankers use, and that it requires real visibility into earnings and over a long period of time, which startup companies just don't have. You're going to look like a rookie. Let's see. Lastly, I think this is important. Don't use an advisor. I talked about not using an advisor to negotiate, but don't use a banker or an advisor to light up a relationship with a seed or Series A investor that they don't know. So think about what I said. If there's an investor that you want to get to and you know somebody who knows them, go to that person for a warm intro. But if you're hiring an advisor, and I do this kind of advisory work, if you're hiring an advisor and they're going to cold call an investment source to try to introduce you to the company, you're better off as the CEO of that company doing that cold call. If you have an intermediary that doesn't know that source, it just makes you look weak. So stay away from that as well. So that's my list of do's, of don'ts rather. I do actually have some do's. Would you like to hear the do's?
Absolutely. Jeff is on a roll. Go for it.
Okay. Well, again, the opposite of not having authenticity is be authentic, right? So you want to be authentic. You want to be somebody that an investor can assess their capabilities and understand exactly what they're getting. Say what you do. Don't, sort of de-jargonize and eliminate all those buzzwords. Don't just expect investors to be sort of sitting where you're sitting and have your level of knowledge. Know the numbers and know the competition. You don't want an investor to say, well, what about XYZ company? I understand they're doing something like you, and have you say either, no, they're not, unless they're truly not, or I've never heard of them. Know your numbers, which I've said before. And then I would say, and this I think is very important. You need to know your 3 to 5 metrics that are going to define success for you, right? So you're a founder. How do you know you want to spend the next 5 to 10 years of your life doing this business? So you need to understand at each stage of your growth what the 3 to 5, and you know what? They're really not more than 3 to 5. They're not 7 to 10. They're usually 3 to 5 key performance metrics that are going to define success for you. And here's the thing. You don't have to meet those metrics when you're pitching an investor, but you absolutely, most assuredly, have to know what they are. And that way, investors can help manage based on how you're trending to those. You can tell a story around that. But if you don't know what those metrics are, you're going to look terrible. So, for example, in e-commerce, it's cost of customer acquisition. It's lifetime value of customer. It's average price for the first sell and then the upsell. It's all these things that are going to define the success in your business. For SaaS, it's annual contract value. It's, lifetime value. It's retention rate. There's always a couple of metrics that are most important that are going to define success. Know what they are, know where you are with them, and track to them.
Boom. You did pitch deck. You just got a master's level course in the do's and don'ts of raising capital. I mean, I scribbled down so many notes, Jeffrey, that I'm like, okay. And I was like, that's a good one. That's a good one. Those were phenomenal. Really, truly. Founders, this episode, bookmark it, because if you need a quick refresher course, which basically would summarize up the entire body of work of the pitch deck, Jeffrey just laid it on you. So good job, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. It really is these little tiny things that founders need to remember. I don't say they're tiny things, but the bullet points of what you just ran down are so relevant for founders out there, and every one of them is important. And so thank you so much for sharing them with us and literally giving us in a almost a list format, do and don't. You just wrote a blog post for me. It's amazing. So Jeffrey, we're almost at the end of our time, but I don't want to let you go without asking you to stand in the batter's box. And this is where I pitch you fast questions and you take your swing. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What resource?
Wait a minute. Let me rub my hand in the dirt first.
There you go. Got to get you.
Shuffle my cleats.
Yep. You got to hit your cleats and then spit. All right. What resource can you recommend entrepreneurs use to help them get ready for their capital raise?
So I would read the blogosphere. There are a number of great blogs that are very entrepreneur friendly. Certainly Fred Wilson's is good. I happen to like Mark Suster, whose blog is called Both Sides of the Table. Mark was also a two-time entrepreneur and a current venture capitalist at Upfront Ventures in LA. Paul Graham's essays, I think, are truly the best. It's one of my favorite. And Paul's got a couple about where good startup ideas come from and other things that will help sort of frame for you what you need to do. I think also, you know, if you're a startup and you need some coaching, there's the Startup Leadership Program, which takes applications. Sort of think of them as the accelerator for the CEO as opposed to the accelerator for the company. So they bring resources to you as a budding founder and CEO to help you sort of understand all the things that are likely to be in front of you as you sort of traverse through the stages of your company.
Those are phenomenal resources, and I'm going to link up every one of them. And the last one, what was the Startup Leadership
Program.
The Startup Leadership Program, I've never heard of that, and I am excited to dig into it. So founders, if you're listening, go to thepitchdeck.com. We're going to link that up under Jeffrey's episode in the show notes. And what a phenomenal rundown of awesome resources. Jeffrey, what book would you recommend to our listeners and why?
Can I give you two?
You can give us. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the first is Ben Horowitz's book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And in Ben's book, he chronicles some of his experience of his predecessor company, Opswares, and the pivots he had to do fairly late in the game, and all of the difficulties that a CEO has dealing with the board, dealing with employees, dealing with running out of money. It's heartfelt, great anecdotes, and I think everybody would be better for reading that. And I think for CEOs that are particularly going through difficult times, it's certainly a good best friend to have. The second book I would recommend is Peter Thiel's recent book, Zero to N. And, you know, Peter's been, certainly a person in our industry who's changed the world numerous times with the creation of PayPal and then being an early investor in Facebook, and certainly later with the Thiel Fellowship, where Peter's incenting intelligent teenagers or people graduating high school to not go to college by giving them $250,000 to follow a dream. Zero to N talks about creation. So if you think about a business and you're thinking about incrementally improving that business, that is sort of one to N. That is, you know, sort of an incremental improvement. But zero to one, I'm sorry, the name of the book was Zero to One. Zero to One is about a blank slate and then creation, which is one. It's not incremental. It's totally new. And it's just a great, great book on how to think about big ideas, and I recommend it wholeheartedly.
Phenomenal suggestions, and we will link up both of those in the show notes at thepitchdeck.com under Jeffrey's episode. What is one piece of advice that you want every entrepreneur to know before they raise money for their business?
Know that every business isn't cut out for institutional capital. So think about that. You know, if you have a good business idea, if you can fund it with debt, if you can fund it on your own, you control that business. You control what you pay yourself. You control what you do with earnings. You control when and if you sell it. You can run it as a lifestyle business. But as soon as you take institutional capital from professional angels or seed funds or institutional venture capital, you don't have that luxury anymore, because those investors are in the business of exiting your investment, which requires either a recapitalization or a sale. And that takes your business and its trajectory in a very, very different place. So I see a lot of businesses, and sometimes I'll comment to the entrepreneur, this is a very good business, but I don't recommend this being an institutionally financed business. Suggest that they go forward with a different mindset.
Phenomenal advice. And in a day and age when entrepreneurship is becoming so synonymous with raising capital, just phenomenal advice to go back and really rethink that, how you're doing it, why you're doing it, what is the purpose of bringing in the money. Phenomenal. Thank you so much. And finally, Jeffrey, how can we connect with you?
Well, In terms of emailing me?
No, or Twitter or on, yeah, how can we follow you?
Well, so certainly you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Jay Finkel. You can follow me on my blog, again, Fink, F-I-N-K, about.it. And that's the best way to keep in touch and see what I'm up to.
Phenomenal. And thank you so much. We will link up both of those at the pitchdeck.com under Jeffrey's episode. We have come to the end of another episode of The Pitch Deck. And I want to thank you, our awesome audience, for coming on this journey with us today. I want to thank our amazing guest, Jeffrey Finkel. We're so grateful to you for your time, advice, and insights. The information that you gave us today is going to change the funding game for our listeners. Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm your host, Gavin McCulley, and you can connect with me at thepitchdeck.com or on Facebook at The Pitch Deck fan page or on Twitter at Gavin McCulley. And until next time, I'm in your corner. I want you to get started. If you've started, keep going. I am here if you need me. Now go out and crush it.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of The Pitch Deck, your backstage pass inside the startup funding game. To make sure you're ready for your next pitch, we've developed our signature 7-step checklist to prepare you for your next investment meeting. Do not make one more pitch until you've seen this list. Number 3 might save you from making a common mistake that could cost you big time. Grab it now completely free at thepitchdeck.com. We'll see you soon on the next episode of The Pitch Deck.